Welcome to Light Years. Biggest game of the season, and they no-show harder than any game this season. This is probably the best way to describe the 2021 Golden State Warriors. Andy Liu is off tonight. I have Aaron Larsoul sitting across from me. Aaron, I don't even know where to start. Like, for a lot of games this season, it's easy to blame someone specific. You know, Kerr leaves Steph on the bench 2 minutes too long and they lose by 2 points. Coaching error. Andrew Wiggins goes 2 for 27. You know, what are you going to do with that? He's playing awful. Tonight, it was just, to me, it was just a collective failure.
Just a complete ass kicking. And you make a good point about, you know, like, who do you blame? There's plenty of blame to go around for everyone. I thought the Warriors were in trouble when offensive possession number one, Steph gives the ball up basically before he crosses half court to Michael Mulder and then never sees it again. And that was kind of a microcosm of everything. I know people in the chat and people even on Twitter have been critical of Kerr and the not practicing. Nobody's practicing a lot. And I think this was just kind of it was a Warriors no-show. I don't think this is specifically on the Warriors aren't practicing, but I think it's another instance of Steve Kerr like tripping over himself and getting in the way, talking too much.
So let's talk about that. You've obviously worked for multiple NBA teams. This, particularly in this condensed season, no one's doing aggressive. Like, what is practice for teams right now? When you have a game every other day, the Warriors haven't had more than one day off between games in a while. I mean, quite frankly, most of the league hasn't. So what happens on, I guess, let's start with this. Tell listeners, what happens on off days when you play on Sunday, you have Monday off, you play Tuesday?
So in a normal season, depending on who the coach is and depending on how well the team has been playing, there can be some mandatory work, but not always. And in these times, in the post-COVID times, people are not practicing a lot. So generally what's going to happen is if you play on Sunday and then you have the off day Monday and then you're going to play on Tuesday, there's going to be a walkthrough on Tuesday morning to go through all of your stuff specific to the game. Right. And then Monday is generally going to be a treatment day. It's going to be an optional treatment day. Guys can come in, get shots up if they want, and can come in. If anybody has like lingering stuff, injuries, they can come in and get treatment. But as far as organized team activities, it is very rare for teams to have full-on practices these days.
Yeah, and I mean, that's for veteran teams, for rookie teams, and for everyone in the middle at this point. So I don't put too much stock into that. It's just one of those things when you start – when you go nine minutes and 40 seconds without making a shot, which is quite frankly just hard to do, people are looking for someone to blame there. I don't even know where to start. Like, it was.
Well, just, the answer is everyone. But
yeah,
like it has to start somewhere, and the start is Steve Kerr. He's overseeing all of this, at least what's happening on the floor and the game plan and all of that. So it has to start there.
Sure. I mean, I think if you want to talk about the coaching, the bigger take is they've had too many games like this year. Everyone's allowed a mulligan game at some point. Everyone gets blown out a couple times a year. The bigger issue is it seems like the Warriors, anytime they gain a little momentum and something's coming up, there's a game like this. And particularly against the Mavericks, a team who completely no-showed yesterday, ironically.
Right.
And in a game where the Warriors could have pushed within a game and a half of the sixth seed and owned the tiebreaker, which really means they're only a half game behind Dallas in terms of, you know, superseding them in the playoff standings. To come out like this, it's unacceptable. And in some ways, I kind of start with Steph and Draymond because they're the leaders of the team. Steph had what, 8 points in the first 4 minutes and then proceeded to not really get the ball much after that. They started trapping him aggressively. I didn't see anyone trying to do anything about that. I didn't see anyone trying to change the strategy to come up with some way to free him up. I thought Draymond was subpar is probably a polite way
it
to
was,
put it.
It was Draymond. It was the worst game of Draymond's season.
You think so? I mean, yeah. It was up there.
I mean, if
you consider the stakes, yeah, he's had other bad games, but the stakes have not been this high. You would think with Dallas reeling and them really smelling blood to get out of the play-in, you would have got peak playoff Draymond,
especially,
you know, kind of like
because
the 16-game player.
Especially because the following six games are so, so easy. It really felt like with the way the Warriors had been playing, winning 7 of 9 or whatever it is, this one mattered for the reasons you just mentioned in terms of trying to get the sixth seed. And then the next six games are an absolute cakewalk. So this is the one where you plant your flag and say, you know, this is not the Warriors team you've seen. But what happened was Draymond was terrible. Not only the turnovers and taking no
shots. The energy level was, I mean, he had like kind of, 10th game of the season in early January energy.
There was
zero urgency.
And that bled over to Wiggins. All. It looked like Wiggins did nothing all day. Oubre looked like the first handful of games. Oubre. And Steph, look, and it's always hard to divorce between or figure out between, is it Steph? Is it the system? Is it Kerr? Is it Steph? But you mentioned it before, I mentioned it, about how he gave up the rock on the first possession and then did nothing, scored 8 quick points, and then went 4 or 5 or 6 possessions where he literally didn't touch the ball in the front court again. I tend to put most of the blame on not Steph, but Steph has to take some ownership of that also and go get the ball and go make something happen. He is that good, so go make something happen.
Yeah, I was going to say they were aggressively double teaming him.
But it's not the first time he's ever seen that.
No, and he wasn't being double teamed by Kawhi Leonard and Paul George either. It was like Maxi Kleber and Trey Burke and Dwight Powell. And yes, two bodies trapping you at half court is a lot. But like you said, he's seen it. And this isn't exactly the greatest defensive team on earth. Like they should have counters. He should have counters on how to counteract that.
Rick Carlisle is a good and creative coach, but Steph looked passive. Some of that is on him. Some of that, look, he's out setting back screens for the mitten. I mean, that is just like you cannot do that. That I don't care what any system you have, you cannot do that. But to be fair, some of that is also on Steph, and he has to go. He is a superstar. He is the only offensive engine this team has, and he has to go and take the ball sometimes, but that is not in his.
Did it not just feel to you like, okay, so the start of the game was normal. They were kind of trading buckets, looked like it was going to be a good game. Then Dallas gets kind of on a run. And then it felt like almost like the Warriors were like rolling their eyes, like, here we go again. That sort of thing. And that's kind of where I put it a little more on Draymond and Steph, where you're the leaders of the team. You're 3-time champions. You have to kind of be the guys who change the momentum of the game, whether it be upping the intensity defensively or taking the rock offensively, be like, yeah, I'm going to force it right now and get you guys on my back. Because like, Let's be real about this. Wiggins is a max contract, but he's not a max player. He's not a leader. Oubre is not that guy either. Michael Mulder making the NBA is an amazing story in its own right.
Sure. But
like the point is they're going to follow Steph and Draymond's lead. And those guys just, you know, I can throw Steve Kerr into this too, because it's, you know, getting yourself teed up after the team's down 35, like great. That's fake hustle Hall of Fame. You know, it's like
make sure they recognize that discontinued dribble.
Yeah, it's like any of those, but all three of those guys, they've been here before, and they know you need to stop a run when they get to 8-0, 10-0. You don't expect it to snowball to like 25-0. Like usually that doesn't happen.
Well, I saw like, a stat. I think it was 28-0, and it is the second longest run without one team scoring in the last 20 years, like tied with the Knicks in 2017. 28-0 just doesn't happen in NBA games.
Yeah, exactly. And it's to me, I mean, like I said, I want to spread the blame here. We've been ultra critical of Steve Kerr over the year. I think we've been mostly fair, but either way, like those three guys, they're all veterans. They're all leaders, the coach and the two leaders of the team. They let that game get away. I don't know that they could have turned it. Dallas could have easily won the game, but.
I guess my problem. Yeah, you're correct. My problem is it's not the game plan doesn't seem malleable, and it doesn't seem, again, for the 100th time this season, doesn't seem to maximize the best parts of this team. Every possession that Steph is not the focal point of the offense, whether it's him taking the shot or him making the decision, is a victory for the opposition. So when Steph has, and I'm, you know what, next game I'm going to chart it and actually count. But when Steph is on the floor, it felt to me, even in the minutes that mattered today, it felt to me like 30 or 35% of the offensive possessions, he was just a bystander on the side. He would give the ball up.
Oh, he was. He was.
And that only happened. I don't care. Only... He doesn't have to shoot every time, but he has to be. He has to be the main initiator of the offense every single possession, or else it's a victory for the defense.
The only thing I'll counter with is, in the words of the great Marcus Thompson, who was on the last episode of Light Years. If you guys haven't checked, as he said, what's Steve going to do if Steph actually commands the ball? You think he's going to tell him, don't?
Sure, some of it's on Steph.
So there has to be a little. We love to talk about how Steph is the most coachable superstar in the NBA, which he probably is. The downside to that is if they're in a little bit of a tailspin, it takes him maybe a little longer to, you know, do the thing that we kind of associate with like Kobe or MJ or those guys where they just take over. They're just like, screw this. I'm about to change the momentum of the game. And it can be a little frustrating sometimes when you're like, you know, Steph's capable of that. And in certain games, he does it. In certain games, he's like, I'm not standing for this. I'm going to assert myself. And he's complete enough. He can assert himself in like 50 different ways offensively. Tonight's game, it didn't feel that way. But like, just going back to the theme, this feels like a collective fail across the board. Like the players didn't show up. The coaches didn't show up. It seems like the trainer showed up, so good for them, but that's about it.
Well, I think it also, you know, as much as we praise Steph, and he is worthy of all of that, this might be some of the thing, and he's probably in the best shape of anybody in the NBA, at least cardiovascularly, but this might be one of those, or this might be an example of one of those times where, because he's small and slight, even though he's put on a bunch of muscle, that he just wears down. This stretch that he's been on has been incredible and has been so taxing physically, mentally, et cetera.
Just a casual 40 points a game for like a month.
Right. Yeah. But so this, it could be that, you know, like there's going to be games because he's so small physically compared to NBA athletes that he's just tired and worn down and can't do it every game all the time. And so again, we talk about maybe, you know, some of this is on Steph. I would guess he's probably just worn out and like doesn't want to go and take the ball all the time like we all want him to.
I agree with you in the macro. I don't agree with you in the micro on this one. I didn't think he looked worn out tonight. I think actually, if anything, what was frustrating about tonight was when everything turned the opposite way, I felt like both he and Draymond had that here we go again, kind of like instead of taking the game by the rein of the horns. I thought they could have asserted themselves more so.
They certainly should have. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They certainly should have. I just have seen Steph decide on occasion, okay, I'm doing mm-hmm. this. And today it didn't look like he had that gear.
All right. Well, I have a quote for you. Now it's getting spicy. We're going to read this quote. Let's react to this one and then we'll bring on whoever wants to speak. Steve Kerr. I'm not concerned about the 9-minute scoring drought. I'm concerned about the level of intensity and preparation and the competitiveness. I did not have them ready to play. Clearly, biggest game of the year, and it was over before it started.
I mean,
I have thoughts on that, but I'll let you go first, Aaron.
Yeah, so the problem with it, like, he's talking out of both sides of his mouth there. Like, I'm concerned about the intensity, but I didn't have them ready. Okay, it's on you. Nobody told you this is the most important game of the year. You said it's the most important game of the year, Steve, and then you just didn't have them ready. They a complete no-show, and that's on him. So he's sort of taking responsibility and sort of skirting it. It's like, again, Steve Kerr, I think he means well. I think he's a smart guy, which is problematic because he steps in it way too often. I think on balance, he's a good coach and a good human being. But he, again, is another example of him getting himself in trouble by talking too much.
To me, this was coach trying to take the bullet for his team. I mean, well, doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that one out. But the real question is, why does this keep happening? Like, now we can talk about it. This is kind of what's been associated with guys like Andrew Wiggins' career all year, their whole career, right? Like, Wiggins always been a guy who people have been like, does he care enough? And, you know, plays a couple good games and no shows other games, blah, blah, blah. But on the other hand, I don't know that this is a team of guys outside of Wiggins I would define as lethargic. Like, Juan Toscano-Anderson's not that player. Draymond Green's not that player. Steph Curry's not that player. We can argue about the talent level of some of the other guys, like Oubre, like Looney, like, well, I guess Damian Lee didn't play tonight, but like Michael Mulder, these guys. But like, I would, if nothing else, define them as players who tend to show up and bring effort on a nightly basis. So that's what is concerning to me, where he goes, we weren't prepared, we didn't have the right intensity. Like, this isn't a roster of, outside of Wiggins, who's kind of been, you know, for better or worse, that's his reputation. I don't think any of the other guys on this team have a reputation for being like, for lacking intensity. They, you know, for the most part, have a reputation for lacking specific talents or
something. Yeah, it's because it's a roster made up of a top heavy roster made up of a few guys making a ton of money, and then a bunch of fringe NBA guys who are only in the NBA because they bust their ass every possession.
All right, let's open this to questions. Let's get some sound offs here. Let's go from there. I'm going to start, well, at the top of the list. Larry, what's going on? Larry, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
How are you doing, sir?
Just to say, on an 8-minute, 33-4 run in the first quarter, reminiscent of the last 4 or 5 minutes of Game 7, 2016, Kerr didn't call a single timeout. Okay, I don't care who had problems with effort. I don't care anything. He needed to gather the team during that 33-4 run. And that was the game. And I'm usually really a Steve Kerr fan, but more and more, I think he's not doing the work. And that's it.
I appreciate it, Larry. I do. So, Aaron, we can talk about this. This is a classic Phil Jackson move, right? Where you don't call a timeout and you kind of make your team play through it, trusting that they're going to have some pride and figure it out, right?
Sure.
The problem is that stuff works when you have Andre Iguodala, when you have David West, when you have a bunch of veterans who don't need you to call a timeout and instruct them. This team, it's Steph, Draymond, and a bunch of puppies, right? Like, they need the Greg Popovich, you blew two defensive assignments in a row, I'm calling a timeout, and I don't want to say yelling at you, but like getting in your face about like what to focus on, because like we saw tonight, young players like that, like this can snowball really quick.
Clearly.
And free fall, right? Like, I mean, you don't expect it to go 9.5 minutes and 28-0
but Steph Curry, who is the only offensive player on this roster, doesn't get a touch. It's not that shocking.
Right. But I mean, like, on the broader scale, like, you can't coach this team the way you coached the 2017 or 2019 Warriors basically played with their food every game. Like, they were just so over everything. They're like, get me to the playoffs. they did stay healthy, but like that sort of thing. Like, but they were veteran. You could, you didn't need to call a timeout because Kevin Durant didn't make a rotation on defense. This is probably the kind of team you should be calling a timeout when they blow two rotations.
Correct.
In a row.
Correct. So you made a very good point. And you and I have talked about this a lot about how Kerr is very much a disciple of Phil Jackson and how Phil didn't call timeouts, you know, and he was going to let his team figure it out. And Kerr got into that habit of letting his teams figure it out because he was a disciple of Phil Jackson. And that's what we're for Phil Jackson. The problem is Phil Jackson and Steve Kerr up until last year never coached any teams that weren't overwhelmingly more talented than everyone they were playing.
Or just veteran. Like the bigger thing with Phil, like his teams were always made up of a bunch of 30-plus.
But it's more He's than like, that. Yeah, they were made up of teams that were older, but also teams that were going to win titles.
True.
And guys
true.
That were not only veteran and knew the NBA, but were better than everybody they were playing. And Kerr has not adjusted to last year and has not adjusted to this year where he doesn't have that kind of talent. He doesn't have those teams that, you know what? Those guys can figure it out because they've been through the championship wars. Because
sometimes it's better to not bail them out because they need to figure it out. Like, I don't know that Kelly Oubre or Michael Mulder can figure it out. Like, they kind of need the coaching and the instruction in real time. Otherwise, it snowballs.
If they can figure it out, it's going to be after they've won a title or two and have been through all of those wars that give you the scars right. and give you the stripes of NBA experience so that you have something to draw on to figure it out.
Absolutely. All right, let's get to the next caller. Jackson. By the way, Jackson is my inspiration for starting room number two. Thank you for letting us figure that out. Now
he did the Nintendo cartridge, just blowing it and trying again.
exactly. We pulled out the old school Sega Genesis, blow on it, put it back in, it works.
All right, yeah, no problem, guys. I mean, after tonight, I've had this take on the Warriors for a while. It's probably going to piss a lot of fans off, but I've been hearing a lot on Twitter like, oh, no one wants to see the Warriors in the first round. Like, the Jazz should be scared. Like, I actually think this Warriors team is better suited in the regular season than the playoffs, because I think you get in the playoffs and you can scheme more specifically towards the Warriors' style of play and to Steph. And I think teams are going to just, as we've seen in years past, they're going to just bully him. They're going to put two guys on him. They're going to sell out even harder than usual. And he's probably going to shoot like 25 or score 25 points a game, shoot 40% from the field. Not even because it's his fault, just because I think he's going to see two, three guys on him at all times. And so, I don't know. I've been seeing that a lot after tonight. I think it definitely reinforces my point, but I just wanted to know what y'all think about that. If the Warriors do actually pose a threat to like the Jazz or whoever's in the one seed, or if you think that they're more suited for the regular season, which is how I think. I think their style of play and getting a regular season long draining schedule is more suitable than in playoffs when you can scheme to that offense.
Jackson, thank you. That is a phenomenal question. I'm going to give you a gem for that. Now, Aaron, I'll start with you. Okay, so at this point, we can throw the six seed away. So they're playing
correct
for the seven or the eight. If they, you know, they could, depending how the plan works out, they could be the seven or the eight seed if everything works out, which means they're either going to be matching up with Utah, Phoenix, or potentially the Clippers. I don't see the Lakers or Denver having any shot to get into the top two with the amount of games left. With that said, what do you think about their chances versus any of these teams?
They have a chance to scare all three of them. They have no chance to beat any of them. That was a really good question. It was a really good point. Steph has been incredible in the playoffs and in the finals previously, but compared to his regular season stuff, he has not been as good. And especially, like, you can see he was good in the finals against Toronto, but Nick Nurse schemed against him with a lot of the stuff you're seeing now because KD wasn't
this is my broader question to you. What are the Warriors' counters when they run into when Utah decides, all right, we're tired of Steph torching Rudy Gobert.
So that's the thing. I think
we're just going to throw to, because like that's what, against Utah, I can almost guarantee you the way it's going to go down is Steph's going to go for 45 or 50 by exploiting the mismatch. And then Quinn Snyder is going to decide, all right, we're not going to just live in drop coverage versus Steph. We're just going to throw two bodies
at him. Correct. Although, so here's the thing. I agree with you. I think the Warriors, out of those three teams, I think the Warriors have the best chance against Utah, specifically because Steph has twisted Gobert into a pretzel in the playoffs a bunch before. Right. And you remember a couple of years ago with Houston, one of the things was they started switching everything. Excuse me. They started switching everything in the regular season, specifically to practice to switch in the playoffs, because switching requires so much communication, and running different coverages requires a lot of communication and cues from your teammates. And if you haven't drilled that, if you haven't practiced that, if that's not something that's in your muscle memory, that becomes difficult. And Utah doesn't do that. So Utah's like trying to switch up their coverages in the middle of a series because
it's going to throw them Gobert off.
It's going to cause Utah problems. So I think the Warriors would have the best chance against Utah. The problem is Utah's offense, you run into the math problem
that right.
the Warriors caused for everybody else for a bunch of years, is Utah is just going to make a ton of open threes because the Warriors, frankly, for everything they do well defensively, rotating and closing out on corner threes is not something they do well out of drive and kick when they're defending the drive and kick. So I don't think the Warriors are going to beat Utah, but I would give them the best chance against Utah, frankly, because I think Steph can torture Rudy Gobert. And I don't
Utah doesn't have
the institutional knowledge to switch it up like that.
Utah is interesting because they have – they're probably running the – I don't want to say it, maybe the smartest scheme. Like they're the most optimized team where they probably outperform their talent. Like they're not the best team in the NBA, but they have the best record because they just playing. Yeah. They just play the smartest basketball of any team. But like a lot of it is dependent on the volume of threes they take. And it's a bunch of guys that I'm not confident are going to hit 38 to 40% in a legitimate playoff series. Like, Joe Ingles will, but is Donovan Mitchell, Royce O'Neal, Jordan Clarkson, even Mike Conley, are those guys going to shoot it at this clip versus an aggressive defense? Probably not. And so you run into that interesting thing where it's like they're a better team than the Warriors. They're doing certain things better, but like I trust Steph to hit 41% of his shots in a playoff series and on volume more than I trust any of those guys. So
I think the other thing with Utah is the Warriors will win a game or two with Steph just turning Gobert into a pretzel in the drop coverage. And then the Warriors have decent options to throw at Donovan Mitchell. So there's like an 8 for 26 game or two from Donovan Mitchell when he just tries to do too much. But like I think the math problem becomes too much because the Warriors, other than Steph, don't shoot reliably enough.
Yeah, I mean, we can talk about, oh, I don't trust Donovan Mitchell in playoff series. It's like, well, do you trust Andrew Wiggins or Kelly Oubre? You know, the same. It's not like, you know, it's not like we're countering with Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant here. All right, we keep moving. Mike Mikus.
Hello.
Mike only calls in after historic beatdowns. Like last time you called in, you gave us probably the most depressing story ever about how your first ever in-person Warriors game was the Tampa beatdown.
I figured he was at Chase again.
Actually, interestingly enough, the shirt that my girlfriend wore to the game at that Tampa game has been like dirty this whole time. Washed it, finally wore it today. I'm not wearing that shirt.
It's
literally going to get burnt. It's like the only two games it's ever been worn for have been like just the worst losses.
I will buy you a t-shirt to replace it, but we got to get rid of that. It's clearly bad karma.
I have two questions. I've been trying to ask this for a while, but I thought that there was going to be some boost from having fans back in Chase, because this is a team that I think always in the past played with such emotion, you know, Steph hitting like deep, you know, fuck you threes and Draymond getting chased down blocks and you know, they play with such a, they used to always play with such a rigor in front of their fans. And I thought that maybe this would be a team of all the teams in the league that would have gotten like, I would have thought a palpable boost from having fans back, but I am starting to worry that maybe that's not the case. And maybe Chase Center just has bad vibes. And I'm curious what your guys' take on that is. And also, is Luka Doncic one of the least watchable and enjoyable superstars in the league? No, and I mean, like, I used to hate Harden more than any other superstar because of the way he played on Houston, and I've actually warmed up to him on Brooklyn, which I find amazing. But I think Luka's taken that title in terms of, like, a – like, Steph was getting just hacked all first quarter, and I really think that took him out of the game when he wasn't getting any calls. And then Luka will go down and get, like, not even nearly touched as much as Steph, and the hands are just in the air after every shot, and it's – he's like actually infuriating to watch. And I really think him and Harden, you know, obviously when he played that way and Trae Young by extension, all of those players, they're like so bad for the sport of basketball and they're just like impossible to watch and enjoy.
Mike, I appreciate the questions. They're both good. I'm going to start on the first one. I don't think we can, first off, they're what, 3,000 fans in Chase?
Yeah.
It's nice. But it's not an atmosphere. Like my biggest take from it is like it's kind of weird. It's almost weirder than no fans.
Well, yeah. Plus the pipe
not that I have an fans. No, yeah, exactly. Not that I have an issue with it, nor do I not enjoy being there in person, spaced out with no one around me. Like really phenomenal experience when you do that. But it's just not the same. Like, I will make a definitive judgment on Chase when they play an actual, like, when they play a game like this, playoff stakes on the line with a full packed house and it's a docile crowd, like what we associate with, like, the Houston Rockets or something, then we can have a legitimate conversation about how, like, it's no longer the same.
Yeah. I've been to Chase a couple times and, yeah, I think there was a lot made of them very specifically trying to recreate some of the Oracle vibes as far as fan noise and interaction and how loud it could get. But when they opened the building up, the Warriors have been terrible since the building was open. So I don't think it's really fair to compare.
Yeah, no amount of acoustics is getting the fans to cheer for Kyle.
Right. And there hasn't been those Steph Curry moments. I mean, there have been, but just not with fans there. So until we see a full building where with Steph, you know, raining threes on somebody's head, I don't know if we can really figure it out. I see a lot of people in the comments talking about it's low key cursed. Maybe. I don't know. As far as Luka, I mean, yeah, he's one of the best 10 basketball players on planet Earth, but I personally don't enjoy the like slow motion foul begging game that he has.
My bigger issue is it gets rewarded. And it's not a him thing. It's like, I don't know, Aaron, we're relatively the same age. We're both childs of the 90s. I kind of like the tension of defensive basketball. Maybe I'm just way too nostalgic and like actually being subjected to blood sport, like 78 to 81 basketball. I'll be like, that was a big mistake.
Is it kickboxer or blood sport where he like breaks, where they got to break the glass and the resin and Jean-Claude dips his hands in the broken glass? Is that blood sport or kickboxer? I don't know.
Blood sport's the one where he illegally throws the what's it called in his eyes.
Oh,
and
yeah,
then he starts doing roundhouse kicks. Yeah, he starts doing roundhouse kicks blind.
So,
gets a little
so,
Karate Kid moment.
So good.
God, every 80s movie, we didn't bring back the 80s movies. They're just so much better. But anyway, yes, Chong Li. Thank you, Ron Dizzle, for the reminder there. what I was going to say is, in general, I just feel like, and no fans makes it worse, because if you're going to officiate by the letter of the law, they are fouls. What they're calling for the most part, like you could say it's foul baiting, but it's still a foul. I just like a game where you have less of those calls, and someone like Luka or Harden or even Steph's done it at times, they go less to it. It's just not good for the game.
No, it's not. And then it is the single like biggest flashpoint that you can tell how the playoffs and the regular season are
right
they're not different sports, but they're like, they're officiated so differently, and that kind of stuff isn't rewarded. You know, see Harden.
Yeah, you can see, you see refs,
Chris Paul. Right.
You see refs think twice about calling the ticky-tack fouls in the playoffs, because even though they may be by the letter of the law, no ref wants to be that guy who gave 21 fouls to Luka Doncic in a 2-2 game.
And, but it's also, interestingly enough, right, the refs that call the best games during the regular season are rewarded with playoff games and finals games. So it's those guys, theoretically, the better refs that are not falling for that.
That's true, too. I always forget about that, but it's like usually the refs who annoy you in the regular season are not there in the playoffs, except for our guy Scott Foster. All right, Joe Ratto. Joe, what's up, man?
One, thank you for having me on at this time, because I just want to say NBA refs are soft and terrible at their job. But my second or my question is, whatever happened to Peter Guber? Is he just too tied up in other teams right now, or when is he going to come in and try to make this team more solid and try to take over for a little bit of what Lacob has been lacking these past 2 years?
This podcast has not had enough Peter Guber takes. I agree with you, Gerard. Thank you for calling.
Are there any Peter Guber takes?
I don't know. It's like, at this point, I often forget that, like, when they bought the team, it was Lacob and Guber who bought it. Because, like, it just feels like Lacob is the full managing general partner. And, like, I understand that there's a lot of – the ownership group is large and it's vast. But, like, until they have a mutiny against them, it's kind of Joe Lacob's show, right?
Yes. And I, more importantly, shout out to Forrest Whitaker. I forgot he was the guy. He was in Bloodsport. I was looking for his name. So shout out to Forrest Whitaker.
For ooh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like 80s movie.
Great movie.
Yeah. So NBA ownership groups are often, except for like that weird one in Milwaukee, they're often just kind of boiled down to one person is the owner, whoever the managing partner and governor right. is, who makes all the decisions according to the NBA. So, I mean, like, I don't think there are any Peter Guber takes unless, as you say, a mutiny is committed.
Agreed. Okay, let's keep moving. Shout out to whoever in the mentions loves to say that I say keep moving. Mike Davis, what's up, man?
What's up, guys? How you doing?
Hey, you know, for a blowout, I'm in a decent mood.
What a squeaker, right? What a squeaker. A lot of drama. Wow. I saw this coming from the other night. You know, they eked it out the other night, and you know, they just didn't have it tonight for whatever reason. But I got two players that I want to talk about. One is Jordan Poole. Does he seem like, you know, he needs permission to do certain things? Because, like, he'll, like, have a wide open lane to drive in, or he'll pass up a three, and then he'll go, oh, nope, let me pass the ball to somebody else. Like, he seems so indecisive. I don't know if you guys see that. And then Wiggins has been getting cooked. He got cooked by Harrison Barnes the other night. He's lucky he missed that three to end the game. But Luka was just – he just killed him tonight. He just got whatever he wanted on Wiggins. And I'm getting kind of tired of, like, you know, like, oh, his defense is – he's a good defender and stuff.
Two-way
like
Wiggs.
Yeah, but it's like, man, I don't know if I see that from him every game. You know, he's locked down some guys, but the better players definitely seem to get the better of him. Thanks a lot.
Mike, yes. I appreciate the question. I do agree with you. Jordan Poole is actually, if we do want to talk to criticisms of Steve Kerr, Jordan Poole is the prime example of it. We can debate how talented he is and what his overall upside in the NBA is, but he's the epitome of a player who Steve Kerr grinds on for freelancing. And I don't know that that's the best way to coach a lot of younger players, particularly creators. Like, there's a lot of, he turns the ball over too much. Okay, well, with turnovers are a proxy of risk and reward. You don't get the step backs and the big time shot making without a little risk taking. You coach Stephen Curry. That's how it works. So I do agree with you. Like, there's, he doesn't play as free as he should. And that is one of my bigger criticisms, because maybe Aaron can explain this better than me, but it's like the two sides of your mouth thing. You don't call timeout when everything is spiraling, but then when a young player – is maybe a little loose with the ball. You get on him too much about it.
So first, shout out to Mike for the voice. He should definitely be doing voiceover work that with the deep baritone. I think the main job, and Coach Thorpe, you know, from True Hoop, et cetera, talks about this a lot. The main job of a coach is to breathe life and confidence into the players that he is coaching. And Steve Kerr, as it relates to Jordan Poole specifically, also James Wiseman, in my opinion, but as it relates to Poole specifically, I think he has stifled that. And Mike brought up that that Jordan Poole looks hesitant sometimes. Jordan Poole is a very, very confident player naturally, which I think is what bristles at Kerr. And I think that some of that has been stifled to the detriment, which is why when he went to the G League and got to have the ball the whole time and got to make his mistakes and just play, he was maybe the best player in the G League. Now that he has come back, I think he is not entirely sure what his role is. His role is and should be Jamal Crawford, Lou Williams. Like a combo scoring guard off the bench, right? Your sixth man, your seventh man, who can go get buckets, which is especially important on this team because they have nobody other than Steph that can go get buckets. Jordan Poole is the only other guy on the team that can just go get buckets. Andrew Wiggins could, but he doesn't have the mentality to
do so. That's another 2-hour podcast.
Right. So I think the problem is Jordan Poole, one, Kerr tried to make him not a point guard, see all that terrible like stretch where he tried to play him with Mannion so Mannion can handle the ball. Jordan Poole is a combo guard that has to have the ball and is a microwave scorer off the bench. The reason he is hesitant is because he's afraid. He's still a kid. He's afraid that he's going to get taken out of every game anytime he makes a mistake, and that is because of how he has been coached. That aggressiveness, that confidence, which does not jive with Kerr's system, Kerr is trying to coach out of him, and it's been to his detriment. When he is making a bunch of shots, when the shots are going in, then he gets to have his confidence and play freely, and then that snowballs, and that builds upon itself, and then he looks great. When he misses his first shot and he's looking over his shoulder thinking he's going to get pulled, then he gets hesitant and doesn't drive and doesn't know what to do, and it's and pauses and dribbles, takes one dribble and stops and looks for somebody to pass to. So to me, that is on the development and the coaching, because Jordan Poole is sorely needed and is the only guy that can get a bucket other than Steph.
Agreed. And, you know, a lot of this comes back to Steve Kerr took over a team that had a bunch of players who were veteran or had gone through the growth period. Like, he took over a bunch of guys who were on the verge or were veteran. Like, Steph was already an all-star. Clay was on the verge of all-star. They weren't at the beginning stages of development the way that Jordan Poole is. And it's just a reminder that, like, not all coaching is the same, right? Like, just because you know how to coach veterans doesn't mean you know how to develop guys. Just because you know how to develop guys doesn't mean you know how to coach veterans. We just watched, like, Kenny Atkinson, who I think is a really good coach and did a lot of good things for Brooklyn. Doesn't much matter when you get Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, you can't get their buy-in in what you want to do, right? Like, those are two distinctly different jobs. So
correct. Well, I think the other part though is he had some guys that were were mid to early veterans, mid veterans. But in addition to that, we always, you know, if you watch the Jordan documentary or just are a fan or a historian of basketball, teams come up against nemesis and get beat up in the playoffs a bunch until you finally get over that hump. And that's what the Warriors did under Mark Jackson, right? The Spurs got them, the Clippers got them. So they had been through those wars in the playoffs, and then Kerr comes in at the later stages of that. So it wasn't just like they were veterans personally, but the team had coalesced and had been through those wars and was ready to get over.
Right. It was a perfect, like, the right guy meeting the right group of guys type of thing. All right, keep moving. Forget my guy, Omar.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys. I'm in the weird position of slightly defending Kerr, but honestly, I feel like
he's for the most part been kind of coaching his ass off relative in the past month or so relative to the bullshit he was doing pre-Wiseman injury.
Chasing wins.
That even extends to chasing wins, and that even extends to like his management of Poole. I feel like I kind of disagree with your guys' take on this. Poole feels like in, you know, recent weeks he's had a bit of a long leash. I think he's just a young guy that, like, he misses some shots. When he shoots badly, it looks really bad, and he kind of gets in his own head. He looks to me like a guy who kind of needs, like, some consistent practice. He gets a little, like, he needs to be in the groove a bit. So that's not my issue with, like, Kerr, you know, tonight generally, right so far. The thing that I'm mostly concerned about is, like, the tweet that Slater put out, you know, showing the margins of losses that we've had this year and just how absurd they are, like ranging from, you know, 50 to 30 and like a bunch of them clustered in between. That's kind of crazy. I feel like I didn't even see those margins that regularly when I was watching, you know, the Eric Paschal tankathon last year. So that's the part where I'm getting a bit concerned, where, you know, like for all the lack of X's and O's and adjustments and plan B's that Kerr has, there's a distinct lack of, you know, mental strength on this team. Not to bring like a, you know, Arsenal fan TV type of trope, but it's like the chips are down and, you know, these guys, it's kind of like late stage Wenger, really. Like, you know, you have a beautiful system.
You're not wrong. Works well, I agree with you. Yeah.
And then when the chips are down, it's like, you know, everybody looks scared. Wiggins looks like he wants to be back in, you know, some, you know, place in Minnesota.
This is really interesting. Bad.
And that's, Omar, that's by the way, I'm concerned about. Yeah, thanks.
I 100% agree with you, and that was a great call. Saeed in the mentions goes, once Draymond checks out, it's over. And I'm having a hard time disagreeing with him there, because, like, you know, that no one stands Steph harder than the Light Years podcast. But in many ways, Draymond is kind of the bad cop that gets the team going. Well, and you kind of need him to be.
Fitz will tell you he's the emotional Dre, is the emotional heartbeat of the team. So
have I heard that before? I don't know.
When that goes, it's a wrap.
Yeah. To Omar's broader point, that's a fair point in Jordan Poole. That is fair. Jordan Poole is still figuring it out. Like he is a gunslinger. If it's bad, it's bad. There's no way around that.
Yeah, but fine. But if on a team where you need to rein that back in because there's somebody else you would rather try, fine. But with this roster, if he starts 0 for 3 and there are three bad ones, who do you want taking the fourth? Steph or him? I don't. It's nobody else. So, like, what is the alternative in this case?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And then finally, to his last point, like, this roster just kind of is what it is on some level. Like, we can go. Oh, sorry. Actually, I want to get to this point. His point on the blowouts, I do want to push back on this point a little bit. I think no fans has led to wilder outcomes in both directions than normal. I don't know if you agree with me, Aaron, but like, it just feels like when things go bad, they go really bad. I'm looking at this stat that Slater posted. He's posting all the 20-plus point losses they're at.
Right.
There's 12 or so of them, up to 53. Some of that is by proxy related to the no fans, but some of it's also related to this roster.
Yeah, so I think you and I kind of disagree. I think it's more related to the roster and how this team just isn't very good, and Steph drags them to mediocrity. Bill Parcells is kind of like, I think it's Bill Parcells has said, in the NFL, you know, you are what your record is. In the NBA, that's less true. In the NBA, you are what your point differential is. That's much more predictive of your future success or lack thereof.
Right.
And I think the Warriors are now, they were even coming to the game. And since they lost by a million tonight, I think they're like minus 0.5 per game. The Warriors just aren't particularly good. And the blowouts and the fact that they get blown out by 20 this regularly, I think is an indication of that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that's completely unfair, but you know, in general, yeah. No, I guess I'll go with that. We'll keep moving right now. I don't have anything to add there. Ricky Garcia, my guy.
What's up? Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Yep, gotcha.
All right. So, you know, I normally don't miss, you know, Kent Bazemore because, you know, I think he would have fallen for the Luka lunch a lot tonight.
Would have fouled. Was tonight he would have the fouled night out in the first half.
Exactly. But was tonight the night that they probably could have used him?
Probably. Ricky, I appreciate the question. It's a good question. So, Kent Bazemore is like all the players on this roster. Probably being asked to do a little too much. Like, you would like Kent Bazemore on your roster if he was the eighth man, not the sixth man, which he currently is. But yeah, they could have used him because the overarching issue with the Warriors is they don't have enough talent. And the more guys they have with certain talent, the more chance you have that Kent Bazemore is the energy spark to turn the energy of the game before you get into a 0-25 run.
Yeah, so I think, yeah, that's, I'm not going to add anything to it because I think that's the exact point. I don't know that Kent Bazemore actually helps in terms of basketball, but energy-wise, Kent Bazemore would have been invaluable.
Yeah, can
we
hear
got
me?
You. Come on. We got you.
They should give the fans their money back for that shit show. Also, like, Andrew Wiggins. Oh, I don't even know what to say. Do y'all think we should keep him? I'd rather keep Oubre than Andrew Wiggins. At least Oubre tries to, like, play hard. His shots are not falling, but at least he tries to play hard. But Wiggins? Nah. What do y'all think of a Siakam to Wiggins trade?
Is it 7 or 8 draft picks the Warriors are sending?
Are you giving up? Are you, Jamil, are you willing to give up Wiseman?
Hell no.
Picks for Siakam.
Probably that Minnesota pick, but not Wiseman. Hell no. Not for Siakam. Hell no.
So you'd rather give up the Minnesota pick than Wiseman? Just in your order of priority, you value Wiseman more than the Minnesota pick.
Okay, for sure.
All right, so hold on, Jamil, break it down for me. So you think when the Warriors call the Raptors and say we're going to give you Wiseman and the Minnesota pick?
No, Wiseman. We're giving Wiggins.
Oh, Wiggins, Minnesota. Right, Wiggins and the Wiggins, Minnesota pick.
And maybe a future first.
Yeah,
and, future first there,
and give us back Trent Jr. and and Seattle.
You want Drake too?
Nah, hell no. Trent Jr. would be good for us if we ever had him.
We could have had him over Jordan Poole in the draft. I do love Siakam. Jamil, I appreciate the call. Aaron, let me ask you this. I don't want to spend too much on trade talk here, but like, and so I think the Warriors are going to end up making a deal, whether it's the right deal or they do it before everything goes south is a different question. But how comfortable are you with giving up Wiseman or the Wolves pick or both for a player like Siakam? And where do you think that puts the Warriors?
And just
so I'm clear, like we'll throw in future first, but what I'm saying is like the centerpiece of the trade is one of those are the Warriors' two best assets, right? Like, so the centerpiece of the trade is Wiseman plus a couple future firsts, which are hopefully not in the lottery, or the Wolves pick plus a couple firsts, which are not in the lottery.
So either Wiseman and future or the Wolves pick and future.
Correct.
I would do that for Siakam if it was Wiseman and the Wolves pick and then whatever, presumably Wiggins, to make money work. If it's going to be for a superstar, it's going to have to be somebody that I am pretty certain is going to get the Warriors back into contention. I'm not even sure if Bradley Beal does that. I have size and defensive concerns about a backcourt of him and Steph. But for Wiseman, or the pick, I think Siakam is that like all NBA fringe guy, you know, multiple but not always time all-star. I think that's worthwhile. I think that, and I think it's Maples who may still be in the chat, but you've had on a bunch.
Yeah, Maples, if you're in the chat, hop on, tap in.
He's talked a lot about like you can't have Wiseman and the Minnesota pick if it conveys. You can't have both of them next year because it's just too young and it's not fair to Steph and Dre and Clay. And I conceptually agree with that. So, but there definitely is value, and I think there's value in trying to thread the needle, as you talk about a lot with the Spurs, and you know, being good for a long time and kind of restocking the pantry. But I it's a lot to ask of Steph, and I mean, we see what it is right now. So I think it's a lot to ask of those guys. If you can get somebody that is all NBA ish, all star, like a Eastern Conference all star kind of guy like Siakam for one of those assets, Wiseman or the Minnesota pick, then I think that's something you do. If it's going to take both, then I need something at least Bradley Beal and probably better.
I think that's fair. That's kind of what I was trying to get at. Like, where's your line with a player? Like, Siakam's obviously a very good player, a player to prove the spot.
Do you think Steph, Clay, Draymond, Oubre maybe, Siakam and whatever, you know, like guys you can get, buyout guys and whatever mid-level guys, free agent guys you can get, do you think that puts the Warriors back in contention?
I think a lot of it would depend on Clay's health, plus let's assume they do well with those mid-level guys. I do think with a healthy Clay Thompson, that kind of small ball lineup with Siakam, Draymond, Clay, Steph, and another wing is pretty intriguing. But a lot of it comes down to what level of play you're getting from Clay. Because if Clay is severely limited, it's probably still a second-tier Western Conference team because it's not, you know, it's still kind of Steph and a bunch of second-tier players.
I think it gets in the conversation, it's worth doing.
Okay, fair enough. We'll keep this moving.
Need it on a shirt.
Let's get Luke up here.
Sammy, Luke, how are you, buddy?
I'm good, Luke. What's going on, man?
Nice to meet you, Aaron, by the
you
way.
As well, brother. I listen to the show religiously, and your call is always my favorite. So I'm excited to meet you.
I appreciate it, mate. Glad you got me on a bit later, Sam. Give me time to calm down. But what the fuck is that? Like, I just give me a sec to get this off my chest, but what the fuck's going on? Because like you guys are talking about playoffs and everyone's talking about, you know, the future and that. How about we get our fucking attitude right first? Like Kerr before the game's like, oh, we didn't practice all week, it's all right. And I respect Omar's opinion and I agree with Larry and Jackson before. But this has all started from the start of the year when Kerr fucking didn't take the season seriously and said, oh yeah, we're not chasing wins, all this shit. The attitude of these players tonight was fucking disgraceful. Draymond attempted one fucking shot, and Steph didn't even play that bad. He scored 27 fucking points, and we got blown out by 40. Unless the guy goes fucking Super Saiyan every night, we haven't got a chance in hell to win. So, what I'm asking is, can we get fucking serious about what our future is going to be and what we're going to do instead of like. No disrespect to Michael Mulder. I'm sure he's a good NBA player. He got 26 points tonight. He was our second most scoring player. Like, what the fuck is going on? We're going to lose to the Wolves on fucking Friday, Sam. I'm really concerned. And I want to give you a shout out too before I know I'm hogging people's time, but like, I want to give you a shout out for having the courage to put this up because if I were you, I would have just said, you know what, fuck this, I'm going to sleep. Because that was a piss poor effort tonight. It was fucking disgraceful. And people talking about Arsenal Fan TV, you and Andy need to be at the front of Chase Center with a microphone doing these live streams talk because there needs to be some serious pressure put on the front office and the media asking some hard fucking questions about taking care of this guy called Steph Curry. The guy scored 27 points. He played semi-decent for his standards. And they got blown out by 40 by fucking no disrespect, Dallas Mavericks, by 40 to the Dallas fucking Mavericks without Porzingis.
Yeah,
the Mavericks.
The Mavericks JV, by the way.
Yeah. Cheers, boys. I know I'm ranting. I just wanted to say, because I feel like.
I appreciate the kind words.
One more thing, Sammy. If you guys agree with me, if we've had four or five of these performances this year, if this was any other superstar or any other coach in the NBA, would there not be a hit piece the next day from Woj saying, yeah, this guy wants out, this coach is brown bread? Would there not be?
No,
Cheers, boys. I love you all. Thanks, guys.
You are right there. He is correct. I don't know another superstar who would get this, to be honest. Like it would be, there'd be a lot more tension here. But the fact that the Warriors won three titles with Steve Kerr, with Steph Curry, with Draymond Green, with all these guys. So like that's the reason it's not. You know, if this was happening in Dallas with a Luka who had not won anything, it might be a little more uncomfortable, right? Like that's just, you win, you get yourself a little bit of a longer leash. There's a little more patience. There's a little less of the drama.
Yeah, and deservedly so. But to answer Luke's question, can we get our head out of our ass and get it together? No. This is what it is, period. This is who these Warriors are, good, bad, or otherwise. And they're just a bad basketball team, not even mediocre. They are a bad basketball team that Steph Curry, through his singular brilliance, drags to mediocrity. In my opinion, Steve Kerr is in his way. But no, it's not going to get better than this until the roster gets better. I don't know what the brown bread reference is, other than Cheesecake Factory, where the brown bread is not as good as the sourdough. So I don't know the brown bread reference. But yeah, I think it is kind of the gift and the curse of Steph Curry, right? Steph Curry is again, he's the most malleable superstar in the NBA. He can fit in a bunch of schemes. His personality works. He's willing to take a back seat when Kevin Durant comes in. But it is also the curse, right? Like LeBron James, James Harden, whoever else, specifically LeBron, is not putting up with this nonsense. And that has a way of ruining organizations when superstars exert their influence and their pressure. But in the short term, it also often works.
Yeah, I mean, all things in life, there's positives and negatives. Steph not asserting dominance in these situations does allow a lot of other people to do work and in many ways brings positivity. But sometimes you just kind of need a hard ass to come in and just kick everyone in line. So you can go either way with it, but that's life. All right, Maxwell, what's going on, man?
What's up, guys? I want to focus on, usually in games like this, I tend to blame Kerr, but I agree with somebody said he's been coaching his ass off since Wiseman got hurt, and I agree with that. I don't think tonight's on him. I mean, it's on everybody, but I don't think you can really say it's on him. But I want to focus on Draymond, not just for this game, but for the entire season, because, I mean, think about it. If Draymond was like an average player offensively, that changes the outcome of like 7 or 8 games this year. That makes us a 5 seed. That makes Steph the MVP. I mean, so much happens if he's just an average offensive player. I mean, and I'm not asking the guy to do anything he hasn't done. People say he does the little things. He did the little things in 2016, yet he was still perfectly capable of scoring the basketball when he needed to. I don't know about you guys, but he, more so than any player in NBA history, gets the luxury of not having to put up good numbers because people just chalk it up to, oh, he does the little things. You know who else does the little things? Michael Kidd-Gilchrist. The difference is he doesn't have the greatest offensive player ever as his teammate. So, I mean, where do you guys stand on Draymond? What's your approval rating of him? Because mine's as low as it can get.
Maxwell, appreciate the call. A lot of what Maxwell said is not unfair. Draymond gets the longest leash I've ever seen any player get for not being a scoring threat. But at the same time, I it's just hard for me to see this game not going or going this way if Draymond had more intensity. So there's something to be said for a lot of the intangible things he brings, because the reality is there's not a lot of players who can do the things he does. You mentioned MKG, but like MKG's a nice defender and a solid enough like team player, but he's not Draymond Green. Like that's like saying, you know, like, oh well, Seth Curry can shoot. Like Seth can shoot. Seth's not Steph.
First of all, shout out to whoever Facundo who has the Mac Jones Abby. I think that, Maxwell, I think that's unfair. Draymond Green is still a good, perhaps a very good offensive player in the NBA. He just doesn't score and doesn't shoot. But the problem is because he doesn't do those things and all of his value offensively is facilitating and directing traffic. When he turns the ball over six or seven times like he did tonight, then like that just craters everything.
Well, he becomes a nightmare in team building because you now have to construct a roster where more people can shoot because he can't.
Yes.
And he needs to be the center.
Well, he needs
because
he needs to be the point
of all these things.
The point guard. Period.
He needs to be the point guard and the center.
Yeah, right.
At the same time. So I mean, I do understand people who are always like, is it worth it? But at the same time, what are your alternatives? You know, like it's not like you have the option to swap him for LeBron James. Like that's not like, you know, or like you can take it to a smaller level. Like you kind of have to deal with what you have.
Yes. And the problem again becomes, right, if your role is the point guard / center on offense and you turn the ball over six or seven times and then you're not all world defensively. And he at times this year has been all world defensively. He was bad defensively tonight and hasn't been all world defensively. You know, when he's not all world defensively, then you can't get away with the, I'm just a point center and turn the ball over probably too much. And you've made the point. You tweeted out a lot about what the team's record is when he scores just 8 points, which matters. The fake dribble handoffs and all of that, where he can get a dunk or two if he can theoretically get it over the rim when they try to boost him up. He stands on somebody's back and dunks. The stuff that he does at an elite level, if he's not doing those things at an elite level and he's just at a good or very good level, his value just
I do agree with you. And that's what's just the paradox about him. It's like we're asking for him to literally be able to finish plays because everything else he does when he's locked in is so good. And it just is what it is, but it's really frustrating.
But the other thing that's harmful to Draymond's value offensively, and the same is true of Steph, is there's a difference between live ball turnovers and dead ball turnovers. And some guys, you know, it's offensive fouls and it's travels or they step out of bounds with that ball step. Draymond and Steph specifically tend to just throw the ball to the other team a lot, which leads to all those pick sixes, those runouts and dunks for the other team. So Draymond specifically.
This is,
Steph,
yeah, this is
their
why
turnovers are more harmful.
This is why the Niners are drafting Mac Jones. They're tired of Jimmy G's.
Better not put that. You better not put that evil on me.
All right. We'll get two more and then we're calling it a day. JM Stein. JM, what's up, man?
Hey, what's up, Sam? I think we're kind of underrated what playoff basketball, like how different it is than the regular season. And I kind of think we're overreacted. I still think we can be a team that makes a run. Like last year, the Bucks were like an all-time point differential team. They lost to Miami. I think we get into the playoffs. Draymond will actually try. Jackson talked about we'll be worse in the playoffs. I think we'll be better. I think we'll be better to adjust to those type of doubles, and Steph's going to be awesome no matter what. I still think we're going to be dangerous if we get in there.
But why? Based on what?
Based on Steph making 53s.
Steph being awesome. Utah being not that good. The league not being that great.
All right, James Stein, we appreciate you. Yeah, if Steph goes off, they always have a puncher's chance. But like in the broader scheme of things, I just
Yes, I would love to watch the Warriors pull first round upset, but it won't mean anything, right? Like what?
I actually disagree with that. I don't think they will, but I think if they do, I think it's even valuable, even if they just
get it's super valuable for free agency and everything. Yes.
I think it's valuable because it continues the narrative. It kicks the can down the road, the narrative of the Warriors being the Warriors. And right. The fact that Steph has had this MVP level season, I think some of the problems in free agency that the Warriors dealt with this past offseason with Gasol, with Ibaka, with Aaron Baines, even perhaps, the Warriors didn't seem like the Warriors anymore, so couldn't get those buyout-type guys in free agency, those ring chasers. I think it is valuable and meaningful for the Warriors to make the playoffs, for Steph as he has to look like Steph again, and then even if you don't win, to really put a scare in somebody. Because then free agents can say, all right, Klay's coming back. This looks like it's a path to a championship again.
Agreed. All right, last caller of the night, and I appreciate everyone who's listening in. Antonio, we'll give you another shot at this.
Yes.
Antonio, finally. You there?
Guys. Yeah, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Got you.
All right. First off, I want to say, again, thank you guys for doing this. I was so pissed after that game. I wouldn't have done it either. If I were you guys, also for powering through locker room, it's been a little frustrating. But moving forward, I want to talk about the Wolves real quick because they've won two in a row. I believe they're 9-6 when D'Lo and Kat play together. You know, they're the next opponent. And right now they're tied with the third worst record with the Pistons, but they could like get better and then their odds obviously won't be as bad. But then they might have like the odds. So obviously we'll have a higher odd chance to get the pick. But if it's past the top five, it's like 6-12 is like the same caliber of player. So I know obviously we want to beat them. Do we want them to be the bottom three? Because I'm like, I know it's higher chances we could get the fourth pick. But I honestly think like next year, since they have a good coach and they have some talent now that can manifest it, I think they might be like a fringe playing team next year. So I'm kind of worried about that. I just want you guys to take some of it.
Antonio, great question. I think if you get the pick this year, run with it, even if it's number seven, because there's no guarantee the Wolves will be that bad next year. There's just none. This idea that if the pick doesn't convey this year, you're going to magically get the number one pick next year. No, you're more likely to get like the 12th pick or something. I don't necessarily believe the Wolves will, you know, turn it around next year, but like from a Warrior perspective, you got a lot of fortunate luck with Karl-Anthony Towns missing 2/3 of the year. Towns plays, they're competent enough to not be in the top 6-7 picks.
Yeah, I mean, Warriors fans should be rooting for the Wolves to lose as many games as possible. And finish with the worst or second worst record, because then it's most likely to get fourth or fifth. Most people think this is a 5-person draft, but I think the other part of it is you want the pick, you want the Wolves pick now, specifically because you want that time to either trade the asset or to develop along with Wiseman. You don't want to push another rookie that you're waiting on next year, and we're 1 year deeper into Steph's late prime and Dre and Clay and all of that. So you want this as soon as possible. That the best case scenario for the Warriors is the Wolves have the worst record or the second worst record, and that gives the Warriors the best chance of getting the fourth or the fifth pick. But I agree with Andy. You want it immediately.
Yeah, and it's just one of those things where it's like, remember that Nets pick that the Celtics had that like they traded to Cleveland. That was the greatest ass on earth. All it takes is a team to get their mind together a little bit, and all of a sudden that pick is not a bad pick or anything, but it's like
in the Isaiah Thomas fiasco, right?
Exactly.
You do all that, and all of a sudden you think it's going to be the best pick in the draft. All of a sudden it's eighth, and yeah, there you go.
You know, and to be fair, Colin Sexton's turned into a nice little player, but like they had in their minds that they were getting, you know. What's like Tatum or someone like that.
Right.
So it's not the same. All right, we're going to end it here. Appreciate everyone. Aaron, I appreciate you as
well. Anytime, brother.
For coming on.